I'm here as managing editor of Tindall Street Press, which is an independent fiction publisher based in Birmingham. And in many ways, the two books that I'm here and the two authors that I'm here tonight to introduce are indicative of our approach to publishing. They're both, well, as Claire pointed out, actually, her novel isn't a prize-winning novel, but it's achieved the extraordinary heights of Man Booker Prize shortlisting in 2003, which transformed Claire's fortunes and the fortunes of Tindall Street Press in many ways. And Anthony Cartwright's book is a prize-winning novel, I think, yes, The Afterglow, and he won a Betty Trask Award last year and was shortlisted for the James Tate Black Award, and we've just heard that he's also made it onto the shortlist of the very prestigious John Llewellyn Rees Prize, and you're the first people in the public domain to know that information, so congratulations, Anthony. Maybe you're embarrassed, sorry. But it's not the prizes that are indicative of our approach to publishing, it's the seeking out talented new writers and publishing their fiction to the best of our abilities. And Claire and Anthony's novels have something in common in that they're both published by a regional publisher, but Anthony's novel is very much focused on the Black Country and the lives that are lived out in that region. And Claire's book takes place in Birmingham and has a lovely symbolic moment in it centred around the number 11 bus. But in a way, her characters' lives aren't as integrated into the region in which they find themselves as they are in Anthony's book. And for me, at Tindall Street Press, one of the chief pleasures of my job and our role is that finding out of new authors and working with them on their manuscripts and offering them a kind of springboard onto greater things for their work and for their fiction, which Claire will tell us a bit about, I think, has happened for her. As I say, Anthony's book is set in the Black Country, and it's a very compassionate and warm-hearted novel about the life of a family and how they deal with the social and economic situation that they find themselves in, but also on a much more personal level, how they deal with the grief and the loss of a child from their family years later, how that grief is still reverberating within the family. And that connects as well quite nicely to Claire's book in that her novel focuses around a young woman called Kitty who is grieving the loss of the child that she never had and also the loss of her mother whom she never knew. So there are some interlinked themes to the books, although they're very different in many ways and the style of writing is very different. And I think I'm going to hand over to our novelists now to read to you from their work. Claire's going to read to you from Astonishing Splashes of Colour and Anthony from The Afterglow. And then we'll have a conversation with each other about some of the inspiration behind their writing and also some of the themes and ideas in their work. And then we'll hear some more from the authors. Claire will read to you from her new book, her second novel, and we'll hear again from Anthony from The Afterglow. And then I hope very much that you'll be inspired to ask us some questions and engage with us as well. So are you happy to go first, Claire?
Do I stand up and go?
It's up to you. Maybe it might be easier.
Okay. I'm going to read from a section near the beginning of the book, and it's... Kitty has taken her two young nieces to the theatre to see Peter Pan. In fact, she's underestimated how old children should be to go to the theatre, and so she's having a few problems. She's in fact also gone without the children's parents' permission, so there's an element of nervousness about the whole thing anyway. Peter Pan started, and immediately it started, one of them's wanted to go to the toilet, so it resumes when they get back. Our trip to the toilets has not made us popular. Everyone has to stand to let us through, so the people behind can't see either. Nobody says anything, but I can feel their hostility. I can't see their irritation because I'm too embarrassed to look at their faces, but I know it's there. I whisper, sorry, as I stumble over their shoes, guiding the children in front of me, trying to persuade Rosie to move faster. We finally settle back in our seats, and I breathe slowly and deeply, forcing myself to sit very still. I wait for the sweat of embarrassment to cool and dry. "Is that a real dog?" whispers Emily, almost immediately after we get back. I nod. "How do they get the dog to do what they want?" I try to ignore her. "Kitty," she whispers more loudly. "Shh," I put a finger to my lips and shake my head. "How?" "I'll tell you later," I whisper into her ear. She nods and sits back, and for a while we have some peace. "They're flying," Rosie announces with delight. "Shh." "How do they do that?" says Emily. "Shh," I say. "Kitty, how do they do that?" "Magic," I whisper. "There's no such thing as magic." Her whisper is gradually turning into a normal speaking voice. "Shh." People are shushing all round us. I close my eyes and try to work out which people we are irritating most. But the shush is a whisper without a mouth, a manifestation of annoyance without a source. It comes from nowhere and everywhere and circles us, and there's no doubt about where it's aimed. For a time, everyone quietens down. Then Emily starts to use the opera glasses. Rosie sees her and tries to do the same. She slips off her seat, which tilts backwards with a thump, and stands looking at the stage. Neither girl is talking. They're becoming interested in the play, and I allow myself to relax very carefully. I feel a nudge from behind. I assume someone has moved a foot, so I ignore it. "Excuse me." I turn round, and a man is bending towards me. "Do you think your daughter could sit back? My wife can't see." "Rosie," I whisper, "sit down. They can't see from behind." "Shh." The first act continues, and the girls start to concentrate better. I knew they were old enough to enjoy it. Why shouldn't they whisper a bit? Everyone knows that children never sit still. Surely it's the people round us who are at fault. Why have they come without children to watch a children's play? Perhaps they're lost boys themselves who have never grown up and need to keep reliving their childhood, thinking they'll discover what's missing from their lives. They could try to be more tolerant and find pleasure in watching children enjoy themselves. I'd like to suggest this to them in the interval, but I know I won't, because I can understand the reasons they'll give for being here and wanting to listen in peace. We're grown-ups. We come here to remind ourselves of this and remember our lost youth. We've paid good money for these seats, and we'd like to enjoy the play. There are matinees for young children. The other children who come to this performance are older and well-behaved, used to coming to the theatre. They're right, I think sadly. I shouldn't have brought them. I only see Emily and Rosie once or twice a week, and it's not enough. How do I know when they're old enough? How can you tell? A heavy weight settles on me as I see the future stretching ahead of me, with no clear way of finding out how children develop and change. I've lost it all. There's nowhere for me to go. "Kitty," Rosie is at my ear. "What's the fairy called?" "Tinkerbell." "Shh." As the lights come on in the interval, I turn round and apologise to everyone in earshot. They nod and smile politely and say they don't mind at all, but someone must be lying. Shushing doesn't create itself. There are no invisible machines under the seats producing the first furious shh that then feeds off itself and multiplies. There has to be a human source. I can't guess from their faces or their manner who was most annoyed. They all seem pleasant. We go down to the entrance and wait in a long queue for ice creams. Emily is very excited about Peter Pan, and Rosie is excited about the ice creams. "What can we have, Kitty?" "Whatever you want." "But what is there?" I show them the pictures of what is available. Emily wants a cornetto, and Rosie wants an orange ice lolly. When we reach the counter, they only have tubs. "Strawberry, chocolate, or plain," says the woman. "What flavour do you want?" I ask the girls. "Orange," says Rosie. "I want a cornetto," says Emily. "Two chocolate, please," I say. I can't believe how expensive they are. "I want a nice lolly," says Rosie, starting to cry. She's looking flushed and tired, and for a moment I wonder if I should give up and take them home. But then I remember that they'd enjoyed the first act once they'd quietened down. I was right to bring them. I open the tub and scoop out some chocolate ice cream. "Open wide," I say, and pop it into Rosie's mouth quickly before she has time to change her mind. The bell rings for the end of the interval. "Quick," I say, "does anyone want to go to the toilet?" "No," says Rosie and swallows her mouthful. "Yes, please," says Emily. "What shall I do with my tub? I'll hold it while you go." Emily is much easier than Rosie. She can go in the toilet on her own and flush it afterwards. She comes out and washes her hands slowly in the pink wash basins. "Nice toilets," she says to me as we go back. We reach our seats just in time, and I can almost hear everyone sigh in disappointment when they see us returning. I settle the girls down, one on each side, eating their ice cream. They're silent for some time, and I begin to relax. "Kitty, I've spilt my ice cream." I rummage in my bag for a tissue. Somebody pokes me in the shoulder. I turn round and the woman from behind hands me a wad of tissues. Thank you, I whisper, and manage to wipe most of the ice cream from Rosie's front. We relax into our seats, and I think of the people sitting around us. They probably have their own children, much older than Emily and Rosie, and know what to expect of them. I'll never know what they know, even with Emily and Rosie. I'll always overestimate or underestimate their development, because I'm not there every day giving them breakfast, talking to them, listening to them, reading to them every night. I only know children in books, having adventures, discovering things, thinking things, but because they don't breathe or talk, they can never be real. It's not the same as living with the same children and watching them grow. I think about the lost boys and realize that I'm one of them, not the people around me. I grew up without a mother. I'm lost and nobody can guide me back to the right place because there's nobody who can give me what I most want. Kitty, hisses Emily, Rosie's gone to sleep. I take the ice cream out of Rosie's relaxed hands, wipe her face gently and lower her head onto my lap. I eat her ice cream slowly and resist the urge to cover her with kisses.
Okay, thanks, Claire. Is that okay for people hearing? Okay, that's good. As Emma mentioned, I mean, the Afterglow deals a lot with loss in some ways. The Wilkinson family, the family the book is about, have lost a young son, Adam. But also in the backdrop to the family's lives is the loss of a way of life in some ways, with the closure of old industries. So in this section that I'm going to read, Luke, who's close to a central character really as there is in the book. He's at work in the meat packing plant where he works as a pork chop maker, and basically ends up sort of reflecting a little bit on Adam, his brother that was run over, that was killed. Luke walked through the clamour of the changing rooms to his locker. Con had fallen over in a heap in the corner, putting on his overalls, and a crowd was surrounding him, laughing. The women from the marinade room noticed Luke in his shorts and nudged each other. Rose Wolf whistled. He took a crumpled pair of jeans and pulled them on, unhooked his fresh overalls from the hanger. You see Houdini over there? Alf walked over and stood next to him and nodded at Con, still rolling around in the corner. If he's right in this world, I know where there's a house full, I tell you. I know, Alf. Luke fastened his boots quickly. Most people were beginning to file downstairs to clock in. He followed Mario through the double doors, still adjusting his hairnet with his hard hat tucked under his arm. His overalls flapped open and fell off one shoulder. The metal staircase rang with the impact of boots. When he got to the bottom, the familiar disinfectant and meat smell of the factory and the chill of the refrigeration hit him as he splashed through the footbath. The butcher's chainmail aprons hung on hooks on either side of the narrow corridor. The floor shone wet with soap suds running away to the drains, and the factory roared as it started up. Luke and Mario stood next to a wheelie bin of hollowed out and eyeless pig's heads and looked at the women from the lines bustling past in a hurry to clock in. Cool way to start, someone. Luke shook his head. I know, they'll give him nothing for free, mate. They'll give him nothing, Mario muttered. This is later that morning. Luke felt a tap on his shoulder as he struggled with a plastic sack. His heart stopped. A pig snout stuck in his face, its mouth twisted into a grimace. Con's eyes flitted back and forth in the space where the pig's eyes had been. It was a perfect fit. He'd give him that. Bloody hell, Con, it's high funny. You'll get the sack for that. How do you know it's me? Asked a muffled voice. Who else would it be? Don't let Alf see ya. It's disgusting, mate. You'll catch summit. Con wandered around, pretending to tick things off on a clipboard. Luke could see that Indigit was pulling the pallet truck too quickly for what he was about to meet. And sure enough, Indy reached the corner with the truck, looked up, and saw a pig standing 6 foot tall in overalls, wearing a black hat, waiting to check his work. Indy hit the edge of Luke's machine and spilled the contents of the crates across the wet floor. The women stopped working and began to shout at Luke to hurry up. But then they saw a gaffer's black hat and Inderjit scrambling to pick up the spilled crates. The boss turned around slowly to reveal his pig's face. The women started screaming and shouting. Con hurried to the plastic doors, turned and raised his arm in a salute before disappearing into refrigeration. It's disgusting. We ain't gonna report with things like that, you know. I'm gonna report him. Oh, yeah, report him. He's disgusting. He's a disgusting pig. The cleaners, with paper masks wrapped over their faces, came to move the mess. Mario stood for ages disinfecting the floor and the area around the machine. You had to be pretty bored to do something like that, Luke thought. Con wouldn't last much longer. He really hated the job. Nobody liked work. Nobody he knew anyway. His dad used to like it. But for Luke, work was just something you had to do. It was all very well proving how shit you thought it was. But when you had none, that was when the real problems started. You just had to fill your time, that was all. Take the line, for example. He'd just sent another pile of pork chops sliding down the conveyor belt. The women were back in their routine. It wasn't as if they were concentrating on laying the meat out in those cartons. It didn't take concentration, you just did it. It became automatic. Luke looked at Jen, one of the packers, watching her face and trying to work out what she was thinking. Maybe what to do for a little boy's tea. But it might have been much more exciting then. An old boyfriend, bits of a song, chopping Con up into little bits on the machine. You just couldn't tell. She was frowning, kept opening and closing her right hand. It was probably cold. The thoughts that went on inside people's heads, romantic and violent and mundane. Like Luke that morning. Before he'd been interrupted, he'd been thinking about the news last night. Pictures of twisted and bloody bodies beginning to bloat on some dusty Bosnian roadside, with a reporter in a flak jacket giving the details. There'd been a close-up of a dead man's face with the kind of expression that painters give Jesus on the cross, but this man's face had flies crawling on it. The newsreader had said to look away before the report. They always said that, but Luke always looked. There was a little boy lying there at the roadside. It was as if he was just curled up and asleep. And there was something awkward about the position of his arms and legs. You could see where the ground was dark with blood on the other side of the body. Something about it, like he'd seen it before, made him think about Adam. And that had been his morning. Moving on his belly up the road, tasting the dust on his lips, gunfire overhead, firing his rifle over the low wall, crawling over bodies towards smoke rising from burning buildings. He'd seen it in a film once. A girl was trapped under a wall by a bridge. He could see her face. She looked like a girl who worked in one of the offices upstairs, or maybe with Sarah at the solicitors. Shooting. He was going to save her. He got up, made a break for it. Near the bridge, a boy huddled, screaming. Luke was going to save him next. Then the boy was lying at the side of the road, his arms and legs in strange positions, dark stains spreading on the ground next to him. He pulled the handles of the machine down to cut the meat, heard it hitting the belt. That was how the time went. You just got to thinking, couldn't stop, filling in the gaps, the things you didn't know.
Thank you, Anthony, and thank you, Claire, as well. When I listened to, I've not heard Claire read from her novel for quite a long time, actually. No, I haven't. And it really strikes me, with Claire's book and with Anthony's book, the kind of very subtle combination of humour or of wit and of a sense of loss or a sense of grief, I think, in the description of the children at the theatre, there's as you know, you were laughing, there's all these very wry, sort of astute asides about how people are interacting with each other. But also this deep sense of sorrow for Kitty as well. And I think with the beginning of the afterglow, with the scene in the factory and the pig's head, which still makes me laugh. And then we go into a more reflective moment with Luke and how he feels about the loss of his brother. And I wondered if you could say a little bit about that and how you kind of work that balance out, how you make those choices without...
I can say something.
Yeah, well,
one of the things that does interest me, in fact, the putting the juxtaposition of humour with tragic events. And at first it feels, I think people's natural reaction is that's not very tasteful. But my feeling about it is that humour and grief and all the other sort of negative emotions, they're all emotions. And what you're actually doing is that you're appealing, you're heightening people's emotions. In many ways, if you can make people laugh, they're much more open to then understanding and feeling the depth of the loss and the grief that goes at the same time. And it's something I always enjoy reading in other people's writing. And I don't think I necessarily calculated to put it in. I think I'm saying that as a reflection afterwards, because I think I don't think I calculated that carefully one way or the other. I think I tend to write like that anyway, and so that's what comes out. But thinking about it since and sort of analysing the way I've written, I can see that this heightening of emotions is very important in literature, I think, because if you can't move people, if you can't awaken a response in people, then you're not achieving anything.
Yeah, that's...
I'd agree, I think. Also in the sense that I wasn't necessarily conscious in my book to sort of put humour into kind of tragic situations. But I mean, I think the fact is, I mean, everyday life is funnier and more tragic and probably more extreme than actually we give credit for. And I think probably one of literature's jobs, a little bit like Clare in Third really, is to kind of make us aware of that. And there is obviously, there is humour in even the darkest situations, and I think, and probably vice versa. And if you're trying to write anything with any degree of reality or realism to it, I think for it to be a strong piece of work, it must sort of contain elements of all of those things.
I've been struck by the fact you go to funerals and people will tell jokes and will laugh, and I find myself inclined to do it, but I probably need to tone it down a bit. But I mean, within the presence of death and tragedy, people's response is often to resort to humour, because it's also a way of kind of covering over some of the intense feelings that you can't deal with. It brings a lightness to an impossible situation, and I think that's important too.
Yeah, I mean as a defence.
Yes.
As a defence in loads of ways, and as a defence against loads of things. I mean, I think that extra that I read in the book, a lot of the younger characters in my book are sort of drifting around a bit, really, not certain what to do. Luke's a brilliant example of that in that. He's not, you know, he spends 8 hours a day making pork chops. He could be doing something much, much more stimulating, and really is searching around for that. And I think, you know, a lot of the humour in workplaces like that is a defence against the fact that it's pretty boring, really.
Have you worked in it? In the chop
factory? I have worked in it. In fact, I did that job. I'm not Luke, but I did work as a pork chop maker, yeah.
Yes, I worked in a small factory place soldering joints, and it would have been unbearable if we hadn't had endless humour going on all the time.
Well, now we know where the accuracy comes from. And did the pig's head incident really happen? Or did
no, there was always the temptation, I think. But I think that really would have
Would it really
meant.
Go on?
Not putting the pig's head on, I think. I never saw it, anyway. But and I've got to qualify it as well, in that I was there temporarily. So I suppose it's a bit cheeky, in that Luke's there permanently, basically, in the book, or it's much more difficult for him to do something else. So, nobody ever did put a pig's head on.
I wonder if you could pick up on what we said about humour being a way of coping or of covering over, but in both of your books there's much more serious covering over that happens, isn't there? There's a kind of sense of deception within a family, or a sense of denial, and I think that's One of the other very interesting things I find about both of these books is the use of a family or a slightly distorted or unusual family setting to explore people's relationships with each other and also explore the things that happen. It's a very good dramatic device, explore the things that happen when the covering over can't carry on or it comes out. And I wondered if you could, I don't know, maybe talk about the idea of the family and that as a unit that is very, I think, very interesting in fiction, and perhaps in Anthony's book more, you use that family as a way of saying something about, as you indicated, sort of social and economic truths about people's lives as well, not just their kind of emotional things, but that family in that book are...
Yeah, I mean, I think they cover things over with a sense of ritual. I mean, they're actually probably quite a close family in loads of ways, but the ritual of, I don't know, taking flowers to the grave or meeting around the granny's house on Sundays, or one of Luke's friends, Risley, always goes around there for tea on a Tuesday, and they kind of, all the photos on the wall, which includes sort of photos of Adam, which I think freaks Luke out a little bit, as he's just constantly got to look at his dead brother on the wall, but it's not actually talked about or dealt with, although it is always there and really really visible. And this, I don't know, that sense of ritual, I think, the link about rituals, I think they miss a lot of the ritual of the industrial life that's gone. So I think there's a connection there. So I think it's probably quite a neutral thing. It could be really positive, and I think they view it as a positive thing, the ritual of, you know, the family life and community life. Or it's sort of been subverted in their sense, in that it is covering over things that need to be dealt with and need to be addressed.
When I was reading, I thought actually that the covering over was not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I saw that their rituals and that they built up a kind of comfort through it. I mean, I particularly mentioned the going around to the granny's house, which I thought was actually rather nice. And I can think of families, you know, that still do this kind of ritual. And it seemed to me that the comfort of the ritual, it is there, it's safe. It's only Luke who was trying to actually chip through it. And as I was reading it, I wasn't sure that it was necessary for him to chip through it, really. Right. I mean, you know, I didn't get a sort of burning feeling that everybody was hiding things and not wanting to talk about it at all.
No, I mean...
I felt that was their way of dealing with it, which was a good way of dealing with it. You know, sometimes we think you've got to analyse it, you've got to go down to the bottom and really talk about it, and I don't think that's always true, and I think that's what came over quite well in the book.
Yeah, I think that's fair as well, actually. There's not much, I mean, it's not going to suddenly wipe over things and make things be different, so I think there is an element of not wanting to trawl through it. And I think linked to the idea of humour, I mean, that's positive. Mm. In those environments, the fact that it can be funny and you can get along with people and you know, have a good time, even in what could be a fairly soul-destroying job. I mean, that's positive, isn't it? And in a way, that's a sense of covering over. Yeah, that's a sense of covering over, but also a way of, you know, a way of coping, I think.
I don't think my family has rituals. my family is made up of an enormous number of very strong-willed and individuals, I think, isn't it, really? I think when I started to write my novel, one of the things that interested me and I wanted to write about was the fact that people don't remember things accurately, and that there is a sense that... the thing that I was thinking, really, is that it's not intentional. People are not trying to hide things. People are not... actively pretending over things in most instances. What I think happens is that things get told and they get embroidered and they change as they go, and people take comfort from their stories that they have about their past, about things that have happened, and they're probably not right in the end. I mean, my experience is that you think you've remembered something accurately and you'll be convinced that it happened on a certain day, and then someone will give you irrefutable proof that actually it couldn't possibly have happened on that day, and yet in your mind you're totally convinced by it. And it was that kind of conflict, really, between memories and what is real and what is embroidered and become part of a kind of myth in your mind, that interested me. I mean, in the book, it becomes there's quite a solid thing. I don't know if people have read it or not, but there is a... I mean, you could see it as a family secret. I don't actually see it as a family secret. I see it as something that happened. It was about Kitty's mother, and she'd got... stories about her mother that she thought were correct. And people have said to me, well, why did they hide this? I don't want to give the game away, because if you haven't read the book, it will spoil it, I think. But why did they not tell her the truth about it? And I feel that they didn't consciously, they did right at the beginning, I think, hide it. But then after that, I don't think anyone was consciously thinking, we've got to hide this, we've got to keep this a secret. It's simply that people settled into the way of the stories, the way that they talked about the mother. And so it just rested like that. And she challenged her father, why didn't you tell me the truth? And he said, well, there was no easy way to tell you. There's no easy time to tell you. I thought I would, and then it didn't seem right. And so they'd built up this sort of world of stories about the mother, which weren't true. But in one sense, I feel it doesn't matter. It's not that important if what you're basing it all on is not truth in the first place.
Mm. Yes, I think that's very interesting. And that it's not a tissue of lies. It's a tissue, stories that the family have told each other backwards and forwards, and so to untell those stories wouldn't just be to negate one truth, it would be to kind of the whole thing would
be like taking the bottom out of something, wouldn't it really?
Yes, yes. And that subtlety of that psychology, I very much enjoy that. I wanted to ask you a question as well, which isn't related actually to what's in the books, but is related more to the idea of the writer's life, if such a thing exists, because with your second novel, Claire, which is, when is it coming out? It's coming out on the 2nd of January.
Yes, 2nd of January, yes.
and the kind of story behind that, and how it comes to happen that a second novel is written and published, and what it is that enables you to keep going and stay motivated and inspired. And that Anthony will be put on the spot by his publisher about where his second novel is. But I think there's an interesting story to be told about finding the time and the space to write, and also the inspiration and the motivation. And some of it is, as I always tell people, it seems to me anyway, to be downright slog as well. And that there's something involved there that isn't as romantic as all that, maybe. Do you want me to tell us a little bit, please?
I could talk about this for quite a long time. I've been writing for a very long time, years and years and years, and not got published. So Astonishing Splashes in Colour was my fifth novel. I always had this sort of desire to write. As a child, I wrote a lot. But probably around about my 30s, I decided I really wanted to do it properly and I wanted to get down. And I wrote my first novel quite fast in that time because my children were very young and I could put them to bed at 6 o'clock, which was wonderful, which didn't last very long. I struggled to find a publisher. I mean, my first four novels have not been published. I had you sent them around endlessly to agents, to publishers. I had huge numbers of very, very nice letters. And you get very excited about the nice letters to start with, and then after a while it dawns on you it doesn't actually make any difference because they're not going to publish it anyway. But I think that my feeling about writing is that if you want to write, you write, basically. You can't be thinking, this is my great work, I'm going to present it to the world will receive it rapturously, and I'll be an overnight success, because realistically this rarely happens. It does very occasionally, but not to me. And so I think that if you want to be a writer, then you write. You get on with it. That's the whole thing about it. You can't be precious about it. You can't get the novel back from an agent or a publisher and be distraught because they've criticised it. Criticism being one of the most important things that builds your writing ability anyway, I think. And yes, it is. It is a slog. I mean, you spend hours and hours and hours. And various times during these previous novels, I had moments of doubt. You know, I'm spending my time on these enormous projects, which take years of my time, and going nowhere with them. But I think I've just always had a compulsion to write, and so I go on writing. And my way of dealing with it was that each time I would get one back, I would send it out to someone else on a regular basis. But meanwhile, I would have moved on to the next novel because my mind was always full of new ideas and interesting things I wanted to get on with. And I found that very helpful because you get the novel back, it's depressing, and it's very easy to think, oh, I'm wasting my time, there's no point. But because my mind is all excited and over-eager with the next one, I was able to put that behind me and just carry on. And that's really what I've done all the way through. And when Astonishing Splashes of Colour was shortlisted for the Booker, I mean, I'd actually written it and completed it probably about 2 years beforehand with one way and another. It takes a very long time to get to publication. So I was already getting towards the end of the next novel. So it wasn't, so I didn't struggle to produce a second novel because it was almost done anyway at that point, which was quite nice from my point of view because I felt good about this novel, the second novel, and felt it was going well. And I didn't have this terrible crisis of how do I follow one success with another one. And the reason, I mean, in fact, it was finished a year ago last September, but the reason it's taken so long is that it was bought by another publisher and they didn't want to bring it. They were timing it precisely for when they wanted to bring it out, which is this January. So that it's been a very long wait, but it's going well. So, I mean, things are progressing nicely towards it all, so quite happy with it now, having waited all that time. And in fact, they gave me a two-book deal, so I'm, in fact, about two-thirds of the way through the following novel, because this alarming business of having a two-book deal, which I've never had in my life before, of course, and you suddenly think, my goodness, they're paying me for something that doesn't exist, which is quite frightening.
Very nice.
Yes.
Very nice to be paid for something that doesn't exist.
I think a couple of things, really. Just to say, I think what you said about it being slog and about it being habit, really, I think as prose writers, I mean, one of the things you have to aim for is actually getting an amount of words, a body of words to work with, really. And it is habitual. If you sort of get into a run or get into a routine, really, I think is really helpful. And all that advice about not being precious about it is definitely true. I think if you're going to write, you do have to just get on with it, definitely. I think I'm amazed actually at people who can produce. I mean, like Claire's mentioning, you know, having children and getting on with writing novels whilst having a family. I'm really amazed, especially at the experience of the last 18 months or a couple of years, where basically, you know, probably taking on a bit more responsibility at work and ended up working quite heavily and found it a little bit more difficult to balance writing time with, you know, with you know, the rest of my life, really. Talking about habits and it being routine, I mean, I was fortunate in that I was teaching, so, you know, you get obviously like big blocks of time that the holidays that are free, and actually the Afterglow I wrote, you know, the main body of it probably over a couple of summers and worked extensively on it in the other school holidays, which seemed to work really, really well. I'm slightly frustrated at the moment, having made a few false starts with the second novel, in that I'm basically trying to tell the same story over and over again in different forms, I think, not to have a really long block of time. So that's taken a little bit longer. But again, it is about just working at it and getting a number of words done, really. I don't think there's any... There's not a sudden magic formula or anything
like
that.
No, I mean, I didn't have a routine. I didn't have time. I would have a couple of hours, perhaps a week if I was lucky. Sometimes if I had to take somebody to the doctor, I didn't get that. And I just found that you've just got to squeeze and grab every moment of time you've got.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes I would go to sleep, but in general, you have to... You've either got to push and do it, or you don't.
Mm. I think that the whole motivation of it and the fact that people are driven to do it, I think, is interesting. I think that's true of any creative process, really. Mm-hmm. But you're right, it's over you're talking about over a really quite long period of time. Even a novel that's written quickly, you're talking about an extensive chunk of time and constantly going over writing. So it is a big undertaking. So it is interesting, I think, the way that you drive yourself, you know, say, oh well, I must do it, so that's it, really, isn't it? There's no real alternative, which is quite interesting.
Okay, thank you. What I thought we'd do now is just hear two short extracts again, one from Claire's new novel, Natural Flights of the Human Mind, is that right?
Yeah.
And another extract from Anthony's novel, and then hopefully you'll have some questions for Claire and for Anthony. Who would like, we haven't organised this, who would like to go first? You ready?
Oh, okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine, yes.
Yeah. Okay, this is my new novel. It's actually a little bit green. This is a proof copy. It's very slightly bluer. in the real thing, which I haven't got, but I have got a cover for it. It's called Natural Flights of the Human Mind. It's a quote from Samuel Johnson, which is, the natural flights of the human mind are from, not from, oh, from hope, oh, they haven't got it in here. Not from expectation to expectation, but from hope to hope. I was just worried I'd get that the wrong way around, but that is the right way around. It's about a man who is responsible or believes himself to be responsible for a major accident 25 years ago. And he's isolated himself and withdrawn and lives in a lighthouse with two cats and basically lives a life where he's not compelled to talk to anybody. He manages to muddle his way through without making contact with anyone very much apart from basic shopping and so on. He does, in fact, start to take an interest in the people that died in the accident. So the people start appearing in his dreams, talking to him. And so there's a lot of sort of dialogue between him and the people who've died. And what happens is that he comes across a very eccentric lady who is actually a school caretaker who's inherited a cottage which is falling down. And gradually, against both their wills, they begin to communicate with each other, and that's probably the core of the book, but there's guilt was my main motivation, writing about guilt and trying to understand how people can cope with something enormous like the man that didn't shut the doors on the Herald of Free Enterprise or that kind of situation, how anybody can go on living in those sort of circumstances. So it's about that. It's about loss again, because the relatives of the people who've died also appear in the book. And Imogen, who is the woman, she also has a troubled and difficult background. Her husband, she married very young, and her husband disappeared when he just walked out one day and never came back. So they're both from difficult backgrounds. But I'm going to read an extract right from the beginning, which is the man's name is Peter Straker, and it's really by where he is in his lighthouse. 30 years from the front, no, sorry, not 30 years, 30 yards from the front door, the cliff ends abruptly, and there's a precipice of 100 feet. Straker lights to stand close to the edge, rocking in the wind, testing his balance, feeling his centre of gravity. He seizes it as a daily test. Is he still here? What roots him to one spot? Can the wind catch him out? He waits for the moment, the final battle, but it never comes. He remains hovering above the precipice, never quite certain why he continues to survive. The waves roar through the rocks below, pounding against the cliff, challenging the wind to a contest of sound, raging, shrieking, howling, buffeting. There's no clear winner, just a meeting of currents below the cliff, 30-foot high waves regularly crashing against each other, the spray nearly reaching him. Since he's been here, 10 feet of the cliff have fallen. That averages out at half a foot per year. But it doesn't work like that. The closer it gets to the lighthouse, the quicker it goes. The elements will win in the end. He once met a young man up here who wanted to commit suicide. Most potential suicides go to the next headland where the new lighthouse is automated, so there's no one to watch them. But there hasn't been a very high success rate. It's tricky calculating the energy required to push yourself over the edge. You tend to get blown off course by the wind and end up further back than where you started. This young man collided with Straker as he came out of the door of the lighthouse. The stranger had his head down, gelled black hair parted in the middle, and his arms wrapped tightly around his quilted anorak, which nevertheless ballooned out like a crimson bubble. He jumped when he saw Straker. "Get away from me," he shouted. Straker stepped back into the doorway, shocked by his presence. Who was he? Where had he come from? Nobody ever walked out here. But the young man stopped unexpectedly and lifted his head. "It's no good," he said. "I can't go on." He didn't go on. He stood against the wind, desperate, his eyes bloodshot and red-rimmed. He looked about 15. Straker didn't know what to do, so he said nothing and watched him. "I loved her. I really, really loved her. She said university, house, lots of children." Straker listened to him, although he lost some of the words in the wind and didn't think he could ask him to repeat anything. He could feel the girlfriend's betrayal, the hopelessness of it all. "She gave it back to me. Great expectations. Really, really expensive. Hard-backed. Lovely smell. What am I supposed to do with it now?" He produced it from an inside pocket and held it for a while, fingering the cover, unable to turn the pages in the wind. They stood there together, the wind pulling at their hair, rocking them, changing direction unexpectedly so that they nearly fell over while they looked at Great Expectations. Tears were pouring out of the young man's eyes, but they were swept away before they could run down his cheeks. I should do something, thought Straker, but he didn't know what. There wasn't a telephone in the lighthouse. The best he could do was leap on his bicycle and pedal to the village, 5 miles away. It would all be a bit late. Suddenly, in a brief lull, the young man leaned back and looked as if he were going to race to the edge. Straker reached out an arm to stop him, but the young man pushed him aside and ran. At the last minute, he veered to one side and threw the book through the air instead, over the side of the cliff. A perfectly judged moment when the wind was at its weakest. He must have been a cricket player, a powerful right arm. Straker walked to the edge of the cliff to join him, and they looked down. The waves were having a good day, colliding and merging, the spray almost reaching the top. There was no sign of Great Expectations. The young man grabbed Straker by the hand. "Thanks," he shouted, "you've been a real help." Then he sprinted back along the cliff towards the road. Straker wondered if he would be allowed to subtract him from the 78. 77, a good number, only four factors, 1, 7, 11, and 77. Much more satisfying. The original human habitation blown away into the wind. There's a smaller lighthouse now, built on the next headland, full of switches and control panels, run by electricity and solar power. But what about power cuts? What if the sun fails to appear? The ship's radar breaks down? What then? One day the experts will regret this. They'll search out the old keepers in their retirement homes and try to lure them back with money. But they will be too old, their knowledge slipping out of their Alzheimer brains. Straker's lighthouse is little more than a folly, a rocket pointing defiantly at the stars, waiting for takeoff, destined for great things but unfairly abandoned, part of the flotsam and jetsam stranded on the high tide mark in the right place at the wrong time. Straker understands its redundancy. I and the lighthouse. The lighthouse and me.
Thanks, Claire. I'm going to read a bit about Ken, who's Luke's dad, who was a steelworker, which we'll find out about in this section, but is now in a position of having to sort of pick up bits and pieces of work from his brother-in-law, which is where we meet him now, really. It was early, 6:30, and Ken left the house quietly. As he left, he'd heard Luke getting up and closing the bathroom door. Ken slipped out the front. Sandwiches wrapped in foil, tucked under his arm, walking quickly, the road wet from a shower of rain. The last summer like this had been the 70s. The children had been small. Adam wasn't even born. He'd been working the 6 till 2 turn, spending the afternoons sitting in the garden and watching the Olympics on television. He'd knocked a 50 in a works game. Mary, Kerry and Luke sitting on the steps of the pavilion. The house had been new then. They'd still been working on the rest of the estate, pulling down the old masonettes on Fairfax Road, boarding up the butcher's shop. He caught himself whistling through his teeth, stopped, thought, what the hell, and carried on. Mick sat waiting in his van outside the community centre at the bottom of the mushroom field. He passed Ken a copy of the Mirror as he jumped into the passenger seat. "Morning." "All right, Ken, all set?" "Oh, of course I am, mate." The van swung out onto the main road. Both men looked up and down to check for people watching, but it was more a reflex than a fear of being caught. Every so often, Mick could help Ken and Mary out with the offer of a day's work. He had to be careful, but they were sensible. That was the reason for the pickup away from the house. Ken didn't do enough to raise any suspicion, and most of the neighbours had only turned a blind eye anyway. You could never tell, but it was hard to picture Solomon on the phone to the social. Mick talked about the job as the van slid down the dual carriageway, away from the town. "It's just stripping these fireplaces, really. It's a lovely house, I tell you. Old girl who had it kept it lovely. They'd lived in India, the husband was in the army, like. There was loads of good stuff at the clearance. The couple who bought it want to replace the fireplaces, saff sods. More money than sense, some folks, to be honest. Anyway, that's where we come in. Yeah, I'll be working pretty much on your own. I've told my blokes you know what you're doing. Trev the Chippy will be there if there's any problems. I'll have to get another job lined up this morning. I'll be back this after. Have a look at some wiring. Whereabouts is it again? Martley. Close. More this side, really. Take as big as Martley, the village like. A couple of houses, shop, pub. That's all you need, eh? As they drove, Ken decided that he'd take Mary out for a spin in the countryside. When the car came back from the garage, he couldn't remember the last time they'd done that. The place was a timber frame cottage with an orchard behind it. Ken worked all morning in an upstairs bedroom. There was a huge leaded bay window and whitewashed walls, except around the fireplace, where he chipped plaster onto a dust sheet and looked at the pencil markings left there by Mick for the wiring. The radio played in a downstairs room, broken only by the sound of the drilling or hammering or shouts from one of the men working around the house. At 11, Ken stopped to eat one of the sandwiches Mary had cut for him last night. And it reminded him somehow of the first time he'd helped open the furnace when he started at Round Oak, no more than a kid, ladled in the metal off to get it onto a cast, worried it would go wrong, chewing his sandwich in the break afterwards, his throat too dry to swallow, taking one of the older blokes' cold tea to wash it down with. 21 years he'd worked there, on the furnaces and in the melt shop. The glow of the fires used to creep into his dreams. People got the wrong idea. Thought the work was heavy and dirty, which it was. Took it for granted when it was there. But a furnace could be beautiful too. Steelmaking was all about transformation, alchemy, a kind of purification. It wasn't something that could just happen by accident. It took all those men and machines, effort, industry, so that when you did your bit, tapping out the metal, for example, there was this sense of belonging to something, of being part of something bigger than yourself. That was what it was about, he'd always tell Luke. It's a crime, he thought to himself. What happened? A crime. You take these thousands of blokes working, making something for God's sake, living the lives and the families they had and communities around them, not just around Oak, loads of places, and you crush it, just like that. Then you expect everything to go on as normal afterwards. Well, things don't work like that. It was a shopping centre now. Maryhill. Even the name had to change. Like someone had pulled everything apart and just as quickly built this plastic town to cover the traces. Like you could with those Lego bricks you'd got out for Alice. Kerry loved it though. Maryhill had formed her in the way that Round Oak formed him. She was more interested in what she got, not who she was. But then that was the problem with people these days. I was a babby when I went to work there, he thought. 15 years old, happy to be free of school and his old man. There'd only been the two of them. His mother had died when he was 8. He remembered a frail, kind woman. She hadn't deserved the husband, Ken thought. His dad was a cruel, silent man. A slight deafness adding to that. Taut mouth, sunken eyes. As Ken scrubbed the wood around the fireplace, he could have been back that day scrubbing the stones in their kitchen. It was a Saturday, and he was meant to be at the district game. There was a Wolf Scout there. They always said that, even nowadays when you go and see Luke play. He had to finish the kitchen floor before he could go. Rub a shine into the stones. That was the deal. Some kind of punishment. His dad stood over him and told him that it wasn't good enough. He missed the match. His old man hated football. He hated everything, everybody. Never relented. Died that way. Ken had never understood why he behaved how he did. Perhaps it was grief or guilt. He knew enough about that now to think it was possible. I started there as a babby, left there as a mon. He forged me, he thought. And then we was drawn off a slag. And nothing was ever right afterwards. Adam had died a few months after the closure. They were running these programs for the redundant men, retraining sessions in porter cabins where you were forced to imagine non-existent jobs into life. That day had exhausted him so much he'd fallen asleep in front of the Midlands News. He never used to sleep in front of the telly when he was in work, but the retraining stuff had been wearing him down, so he closed his eyes, shut it all out. He left the door on the latch. It was Thursday, the night they collected the pools. The boys had been playing out the back. Kerry was in her room, sulking. She'd asked for a pair of shoes they couldn't afford. He'd heard the brakes and the sound of the impact through the open door. There was quiet, then screaming. Everybody out onto the street. Somebody was screaming. It might have been him.
Thank you.
Finish on a joke.
Have you read from Natural Flights in public before?
No, I have a couple of times, I'm afraid, yes.
No, but it's very nice to hear.
It's a lovely proof copy. It's shiny and it's got really nice paper. It feels lovely.
it's really nice to hear from. I've read an earlier version of that book, okay. So it's lovely to hear some of it. Now I'm going to hand over to you, the audience, and encourage you, or bully you if necessary, to ask questions, if you have any questions for Claire or Anthony about anything that you've heard tonight or anything that you've been wanting to ask them. Please don't be shy. Please ask some questions. We'd be very happy to hear them. So, excellent. Did everybody hear the question?
Yes,
I did. Yes, okay.
Do you want to answer
it? I think yes. I think in writing this, I've got a pretty clear picture that the idea I was writing about was some sense of loss, whether that's personal loss or a kind of collective loss. Because in some ways, and hopefully that works in the book, the idea that the kind of personal tragedy of Adam, the dead boy, kind of mirrors or reflects in some way the more collective loss of, you know, a way of life in loads of ways based around, you know, the old industries that were closed down. So that was the idea. So yes, that was always the backdrop. And I guess I think this is probably the way I work or the way I'll be working for a while. I probably would start very much with that idea and a set of characters, and then the kind of, you know, the plot or the story would fall into place from there, really. It's probably quite character driven, I would say, the novel. I don't know, Claire.
I mentioned guilt on my second novel, which is perhaps, I do have a thought perhaps of what I want to start with. I think when I started Astonishing Splashes of Colour, the was a theme in my mind of memory. But apart from that, I think, no, I'm not actually calculating in advance what the themes are going to be. I started Astonishing Splashes of Colour with really no clear idea of where I was going. You know, I have a few things in my mind that interest me, and I'm sort of carrying them over as I'm writing. Sometimes I use them, sometimes, in fact, I discard them because I've gone down another rather interesting pathway in another direction. So the vast majority of my themes are coming in as they feel like it. I would say, in a way, I just wait to see what's happened a lot of the time, and then I will... Interestingly, I can then go back to a first chapter and find that I have suggested quite a few things that I didn't realise I'd suggested that I'd picked up later. And I sort of put that down to a kind of subconscious process that's happening when you start off. You don't always plan it. Well, I rarely plan it out anyway, but I do think there's a kind of a movement inside that's churning things around and throwing them out, and then I'm picking them up later. It's quite an interesting process, really, I would think.
Thank you.
Yes. I can't help thinking about these four novels you've got lying in the drawers.
Yes.
Did you feel it was right that the publishers turned around and be back? Oh, are you ever tempted to take one out and titivate it? It is book number three.
Well, I originally, when I sort of did quite well here, I thought, oh, great, I can get them all back out again. I then had second thoughts about it because I thought, well, the thing is, as a writer, you're developing all the time. And so I was actually quite nervous about the idea of going backwards because it seems to me we should be moving forwards rather than moving backwards. I did read through the last two, I think last summer, and I have an agent now. and I sent two of them to her to see what she thought. She didn't like my fourth one, which I was disappointed with, because she thought it was a little bleak and a little dark, but I actually rather like it. I might go back to it at some point. But she did very much like number three, and she then did, in fact, send it to my present publishers to see what they thought, the editor there. And she also liked it. And so they ummed and ahed about it and couldn't really decide what to do. I think the publishers found themselves in a slightly difficult position because they'd offered me for two books and they knew I was halfway through the next book. And so what they've decided, because they didn't know what to do with it, I think, really, because I sort of feel if it was to be published, it should actually be, you know, it should be clear that it's an older novel and not my next one, because I think probably I go deeper now than I did then. So in the end, they've sort of put it on hold. They want to see how this book does. They want to see what the next novel is as well. But in principle, they do like it. And apparently they discussed it and agreed that it probably should have been published, but it came at a time when you either were at the top end of very literary work, which was very serious and intense, or you were writing very popular stuff, and there didn't seem to be much of a crossover. Whereas, in fact, apparently the situation has changed rather now, in that large numbers of people do read literary novels, and so you can have a literary novel that is popular as well. And so I think it would have fallen into that kind of category. So, don't know. I mean, wait and see, really.
So you were ahead of your time.
Yes, I was ahead of my time. No, I think it was just rather, short-sighted publishing, really.
Yes. Has anybody else got any questions they'd like to ask? Surely somebody's got a question.
There's lots of stuff that's come out around it. I mean, I think, obviously, like I've said, in terms of collective response, it had a massive impact on the area. The steelworks in question in that section there is Round Oak Steelworks, which was in Briley Hill. But actually, you know, you could have picked several like equivalent workplaces in the Black Country and probably and certainly beyond there that would have applied to like equivalent communities. I grew up quite near there, so I suppose I was cheating a bit in the first draft in that no, I didn't necessarily have to do loads and loads of research in the first place. What I did in going back to it in writing about a sort of a middle-aged couple, I did have to sort of check things like timescales, and just double check the stuff that Ken would have been doing, you know, in the workplace. But in lots of ways, apart from going over stuff that I could remember and just looking at sort of archival stuff like newspapers and things like that, and talking to people, talking to, you know, members of my own family and people that live in the community where I grew up. So.
But the talking is research, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, yes, it's more, yeah, it was, yeah, we'll put it that way, it's more live research than having to go and search through stuff. So
when did the, because it's where Mary Hill is, isn't it now?
It is, yeah.
So when did this happen? When did it close?
It was 81, but it was being wound down a bit, a lot before. I mean, obviously it's part of the...
81, so when did they build Mary Hill?
That was being built for over a couple of years, sort of early 80s. I think, did it open in 84? I think. Yeah, so it's like, it's kind of like sort of, the site is a massive site.
Right,
and then
around
so the site where the shopping centre is actually next to where the steelworks was. Yeah, so it was like a protected area. And I think Mary Hill itself opened in 84, but it's like, various bits of it have opened, and just sort of sprawled since then.
Can I have something leading on from that? Because I'm very interested, because Claire said about how she's sort of full of ideas, and she's always got ideas going bubbling around, and she writes from those ideas. But you seem to be saying that a lot of the stuff that the first novel was based on was experiential stuff, and I wonder whether is that why perhaps you're having difficulty with your second novel, or trying to write something that's not
No, I think I probably am writing something that's experiential, I would imagine. It'd be interesting moving away from that, because I think obviously in terms of a writer's development, I think that has to happen eventually, really. In some way, and I think the urge would be to try and do that actually as well, probably. I mean, not at the moment. No, I mean, I think that the problem I've had at the moment is trying in writing a certain novel, actually, is I've probably got a kind of clear idea of what I want to write about, which is about actually going to extremes and extremism of some sort. And obviously, that's quite topical in loads of ways. And it's sort of the book I'm writing started as some kind of comedy about the BNP, which wasn't really working really well. So, the point being, and that's mixing a load of things that we've talked about already tonight. In that, obviously, life is light and shade. Real life is light and shade. It was set in the setting of the book that I'm writing now. It's based in the Midlands. I think one of the problems is when, in what I first started writing, like was that real events kept catching up with what I was actually writing about. So. That's made a bit of a, well, it's made me think a little bit about the setting, because actually, rather than writing something that's purely documentary or purely experienced, I'd actually like to write something that reflects something a bit wider about the urge to go to extremes, or, you know, the motivations to that, and what makes us maybe not, what makes people step back from extreme reactions. That's the idea anyway. Like I said, it's been written in various ways already, or that's what's going on. But we'll see. I'll see what it goes.
Can I ask whether you race ahead to finish a novel and then look for comments, or do you have someone that you feel very confident in getting feedback on your work as you produce it? It sounds like you mentioned some false starts. Are they false? You've reread them and not found them wanting, or have other people made suggestions that your work's wanting?
I mean, no. At the moment, it's been sort of me doing that, but not that would probably give the impression that I was probably like hypercritical of my own work, whereas the opposite is probably true. I think it's better to get a block of writing done and go, yeah, I've done it, and then rely on some good editing from Tindall Street, really. I think that seemed to be the model before. I think it is better to have a block of text, really. To work with. I mean, you can't. It'd be painful, wouldn't it? I mean, I don't know.
I belong to a writing group which I sort of value very highly, because I think you always need an outsider to see it. That's my feeling about it. And I belong to a writing group that meets about three times a year, and they're very good to me because I tend to circulate about three or four chapters in one go, and I pre-circulate it, so they've read it by the time we get there. Some of them only bring a poem, so I, in fact, do rather well out of it.
not an epic poem.
Well, occasionally we get the epic poem, yeah. but personally, this is a great sort of reassurance type thing, that, and I've, in all, well, for my last three novels, probably, I've been doing this, and there have been several occasions when I've got to about 10 chapters, yes, great, wonderful, going really well. Well, I mean, they don't say that because they're fairly critical, I mean, because that's the object of the exercise. And then they'll say to me, it's going a bit flat here, this isn't working terribly well, and I've kind of gone home, had a crisis, thought, what on earth am I going to do, and thought about it, and then taken off in another direction. So I actually find it very stimulating to be criticised. I think that criticism from other people is hugely valuable, and I would feel quite unsafe without being able to feel that I could get some feedback off something. So I'm doing it as I go. I find that very helpful. I would feel probably not terribly confident by the end of a novel if nobody'd seen bits of it on the way.
That's interesting.
I mean, I have to say, we've been meeting for a very long time, so we all know each other very well, so we are not into the sort of, oh, this is lovely type thing, but much more sort of critical and looking for deeper problems and overall structures and things like that. So we're very honest with each other, but we do try to remember to be encouraging as well, because there's a danger that you forget that.
Can I ask something about structure with Claire, or about the writing? I mean, from both the books you've read from tonight, there's a... Just writing in the sort of present tense and in the first person, it gives it a real immediacy, which I think works really brilliantly.
This one isn't first person.
But I'm sorry, it's not, is it? But it's still sort of present, you know, it's in the
writing in the present tense, that's quite, or when I've tried it, it's quite hard to sustain over a long
I think it's something I the one I'm writing at the moment, I've got some bits set in the past, which I'm putting into third person, and I'm putting into past tense and everything, and I find I'm slipping back into present tense by mistake.
Oh, right, okay.
And this one, in fact, is told from the point of view of two characters, and originally I wrote them as two first person characters.
Right.
My agent felt there were various things wrong with it, and I actually rewrote it into third person for both of them. But I think the good news about that was that I'd had that immediacy because I was writing in first person to start with.
Okay.
But I like writing in third present tense because I think it's a kind of like it's as you're thinking, really. I find it quite harder to go into third person.
Right, okay.
So I suppose it's a habit, isn't it, really?
I think so, yeah. I wanted to check whether it was a conscious decision, but obviously in that it's been really thought through in that.
Oh, yes, I have thought about it.
In the recent book, yeah, that's good. I won a Betty Trask Award, and then I was shortlisted. Yeah, well, there's a bit of loving in this, but I thought I'd keep it. It's not. It's four. They word it.
Yeah.
Betty Trask Award's a funny one because it's worded as, isn't it? Worded as romantic fiction and traditional novels.
Odd,
I wonder if that comes back. I wonder if that. It comes back to the idea of it's, you know, third person past tense.
It means non-experimental, I think. We didn't have to point out the romantic love interest.
There isn't really any romance at all.
Well, maybe that's what the traditional is, like you say, third person.
It might be. I wonder if that might have squeezed in.
That's an interesting point, isn't it?
Mm. Mm,
does the publisher decide?
That's our job. Yeah, and one of the things that we can do on a serious note, as a small publisher, we can't spend lots of money on marketing or on adverts on the tube, or we can't necessarily guarantee things like, you know, interviews in The Guardian or whatever. But one of the things we can do is be resourceful about how we promote our books. And for Claire's book, say, for the Booker Prize, each publisher or each imprint in the UK is allowed to submit two novels to the Booker Prize. So the advantage of being a very small publisher that only publishes six books a year, three of which are anthologies of short stories, are that they're all, yes, basically, and we do that, and we've done that in the years before Claire's book, and we've done it since. And the same for Antony's, so part of our marketing strategy for Antony's book would be to say, right, which prizes can we enter him for? And luckily, he's cast as a young writer, and there are prizes for first novelists over under 35, which is what the Betty Trask is a young author's thing. And the John Llewellyn Rees Prize is also for young authors. The James Tate Black wasn't. That was something else. But we choose to do that, and it's part of our commitment to our writers. I hope she does get on the orange list, yes.
Who knows?
I hope so, yeah. And there's no guarantees, obviously, and, you know.
I didn't know it had been entered for the Booker Prize, I have to say, till my daughter rang me up and told me I was on the long list, which was fairly devastating. I couldn't believe it. Well, I didn't believe it, actually. My daughter ended up not believing it either after she'd phoned to tell me.
It
cannot be true, yes.
It's a typo here,
yes.
But one of the things about that, obviously, is it kind of lifts your expectations so eagerly at 3:30 on the day that the book long list is announced. You're there watching the website, yes, thinking, oh, are we going to get anybody on this year? Yeah. But it's, you know, it's we've had a run of good fortune with prizes. And that, for me, as a publisher, well, it makes me very proud, and it says a lot about our ambition for our authors, and also it says a lot about their talent, because you can't buy your way onto a prize long list or short list or award. So.
Could you ask something about itself? Is it the case that there's lots of talent out there, but it's just not one.
No, no, it's an interesting question. I think about this quite a lot, actually, about the... There's lots and lots of talent out there, that goes without saying, and there's also lots of talent out there that is overlooked or neglected or unheard for one reason or another. And I don't know, and I still can't, work this out, whether talent rises to the top or whether, mm-hmm. in some cases, people who are exceptionally talented remain overlooked. Mm. And you see it a lot in the music industry, for example, that and some people start to rise to the top and then some piece of bad fortune knocks them back down again. You see it in sport as well. But I'd come back to this kind of, maybe it's a bit of an obsession with me, but this idea of slog and hard work, actually, and training, which is what writing is as well, and sitting down at your desk and doing it. It's training. It's like it's pouring with rain at 10 o'clock at night. You still go out for a run. You still sit and do the work. So I don't know what the answer is, really, but the other thing is that Tindall Street Press might not be the right place for lots of the talent that is out there, that there are lots of other opportunities to be published or to make your work known that doesn't necessarily involve it being published in a book form by a local publisher. So that, as I say, I don't know what the answer to that question is at the moment. I'm still... trying to work that one out.
There you go.
It's always been the great book, the great novels about Birmingham, about working experience. It's quite tough. It's clearly got no real empathy or understanding of working experience, but repeats the patterns of their speech as if he understands what they're saying, and he doesn't.
It's funny because I was thinking about writing a book about toffs, but I might stick to
it.
I might well stick to what I know, really.
Have you read Painter Man, Jeff Phelps? Because that's also very black country centred.
Well, it's just, you know, when you see people talking about it on a map,
that's really, the way that's really
it is,
it's really great to hear a representative experience of the place being produced really wonderfully articulated.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you think so. I mean, I think there's...
Sorry? Oh, right. Oh, how can you tell then? He makes comments.
Did you have a question? Naming no names, obviously.
Not beat about the bush, but this must be a difficulty for the press.
No, for me personally, I'm very, very pleased.
Oh, yes, I can see that, you know, altruistically.
No.
You've got to remember that publishers are doing different things. Yeah. You see, my book deal that I had was with Scepter, which is part of Hodder and Stoughton. They're a big publisher, and they made me a good offer. What Tyndall Street are doing, they don't want to be big, do you? I mean, that's not really your... perhaps you do.
No, I mean, it's a crass analogy, but use a footballing analogy, for example. You have a small, I can't think, Grimsby or somewhere, small team, nurtures their talent. The talent does well, gets spotted by Chelsea, goes off and joins a bigger club. That's how it is. And otherwise, everybody would be, as you say, at a level. And one of the things that we see as our job, as I said earlier, is to act as a springboard. Mm. And it makes me very glad, and I think we've done our job well, because we've acted as a springboard for Claire to go on to, you know, for me it's a source of pride that one of our authors can go to a big publishers like Scepter. And but we wouldn't necessarily,
You wouldn't necessarily want to take on that role, I always see, because you have a more sort of slightly idiosyncratic way for example, you like the regional work, and you're doing a job that most big publishers, in fact, wouldn't do, because they wouldn't be interested in the regional work. Yeah. So publishers have different sort of ethos, really, don't you?
And different. And we will always be the publishers of Astonishing Splashes of Colour. and that will always be the case. I feel very glad about it, and I feel very glad for Claire, and I feel very glad for the press that, as I say, that we've acted as such an effective springboard.
And I should say that, in fact, Scepter are publishing in association with Tyndall Street Press. It was one of the things that my agent asked when we offered it to various publishers, is there a way that we can involve Tyndall Street Press? And so it's perhaps more nominal than anything else, but it's nice that Tyndall Street Press are sort of considered to be part of the process.
So there's a relationship not just between me and Claire, as it were, but also between Tyndall Street Press and Scepter.
Do you still
want
to get the books distributed?
Oh, that's a tricky question. our aim is to have our books in bookshops throughout the UK. That's what we aim to do. And we have a distributors to enable us to do that. So it's no more or less of a struggle for us than it is for any other small publisher. Did anybody else want to ask a question or make an observation? No? Well, I'm going to finish now, I think, but I am also going to encourage you to buy books, obviously, before we finish. I think there's some... I'm good. There's a stall outside, and I know that Claire and Anthony would be happy to sign their copies of your books if you'd like them to. So I'd like to say thank you very much to Claire Morrell, and thank you very much to Anthony Cartwright. Thank you to you.